Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. Become a fan of Beyond the Book on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to the free podcast and never miss a program at www.beyondthebook.com.
On behalf of everyone at Digital Hollywood, welcome to the program we call Drafting the Next New Media Contract. My name is Chris Keneally. I'm the Director of Author Relations for Copyright Clearance Center at copyright.com. I'm also the producer and host of a podcast series we call Beyond the Book, and we do hope you'll check out all of that at beyondthebook.com. Very lucky to have here a panel that's going to introduce me to some very interesting information. I should say, first of all, that at copyright.com, we are specialists in licensing of text, but we are learning a great deal more about the licensing of all media, new and old. And I'm looking forward to hearing from our panel about that today. It's especially important for me coming from Boston, and I know it's hard to tell, but that is where I'm from, to hear the Hollywood perspective on things. And I got a bit of a taste of that yesterday when I went to see an agent, and I came into his office, and he said to me, "My God, what are you wearing?" And I said, "Dick, it's called a suit and tie." But, you know, in Boston, that's pretty much par for the course, less so out here. And I'm also interested in the way that Hollywood treats contracts. Again, you know, steeped in the sort of white shoe law firm tradition of the East Coast. I remember the line from Samuel Goldwyn about a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on. And I think that summarizes at least the old style of contracts in Hollywood. So with all of that, let me introduce our panel, moving here from my right out. Alan Friel is a partner in the Intellectual Property Department of Wildman Harold. He counsels his clients on contractual transactions, intellectual property, regulatory compliance, and many other issues. Those clients span a number of industries, including advertising and promotion, film, television, animation, music, and so forth. He is widely published and a member of the Entertainment, Intellectual Property, Technology, and Advertising sections of several bar associations. Welcome, Alan. Beside Alan is John Gaddy. He's a partner at Strook & Strook and Lavin. John has more than 20 years of litigation experience in state, federal, and bankruptcy courts, and his practice includes representing individual corporations in complex business and commercial disputes. He's had extensive trial experience in a variety of industries, and Hollywood Reporter named him one of the nation's 100 most influential entertainment attorneys in the country over the last several years. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Beside John is Virginie Parent. She is a partner of the Artist Law Group. Her practice encompasses all aspects of the entertainment and media industry, with a focus on the convergence of content and technology. Prior to co-founding Artist Law Group, Virginie was Vice President of Business Affairs for Singmail, an online music marketing company. Welcome, Virginie. And finally, we have beside her Cindy Charles, who is a Senior Vice President and General Counsel for MediaNet. Cindy is responsible for MediaNet's business and legal affairs, which include overseeing content licensing, partner contracts, and government relations. Among her previous positions includes a number of posts at MTV Networks, including Vice President of Law and Business Affairs. And she also serves or has served in various legal positions at World Vision Enterprises, the Screen Actors Guild, and several law firms. Finally, welcome, Cindy.
Thank you very much.
And welcome to all of you. So with all of that by way of introductions, I'd like to get started by chatting with Alan briefly, because your position in sort of preparing all these contracts is probably a good way to set the table for the discussion. And the first question I have, though, is one which I asked all of the panelists before we gathered today, and that is your own definition, Alan, of new media. New media could cover a multitude of sins, and I think you prefer a different term.
Well, it's not so new anymore, is it? So I prefer the term evolving media. We were just talking before the session about all being from the days of dictaphones and hand redlining. So technology clearly has changed a lot during the course of our careers. Indeed, it's changed a lot in the last 12 months, the last 18 months, and it continues to evolve. And so thinking of it not necessarily as something new, but something that's evolving, I think is not only a more accurate description, but also I think it keeps our eye on the ball when it comes to contracts. If something is evolving, you don't necessarily want to lock yourself in for a 5-10-year term. Indeed, you probably don't want to be locked in for much more than a year when there's not a business model yet, when you're not sure what all the technology platforms that you may be able to exploit the content are on. And to the extent that you're going to have a longer term, we can talk a little bit about some of the things that I think are important to consider, whether you're a licensor or a licensee, such as scope of grant, exclusivity, minimums, renewals, things like that.
Well, before we talk about some of those details, let me ask you how comfortable the people you work with are with hearing you say such a thing. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, we're flying this plane while we're building it. It's another thing if there's money on the line here and reputations and so forth. Do people accept that? And if they do, how do you, or if they don't, I should say, how do you help them accept that kind of a situation?
Well, a lot depends upon who your client is. If you are the party that is either the licensee or you are acquiring all rights or some category exclusive rights in content, then you're going to want as long a term as possible, as broad a definition of the scope of rights as possible. And so it behooves you to go for a land grab. But to the extent you are the creator or you are the licensor, you know, unless you're getting just a ton of money and you're comfortable with that as a buyout, then it behooves you to carve things up very narrowly, avoid exclusivity, and to have a short term or to have a term that only renews subject to certain economic or other milestones being hit.
You know, we have spoken about how it's all new media today, but there are some parallels with prior situations. And you mentioned one, Alan, to me, which was the advent of television. What is familiar to you with that history, and how have you applied some of the lessons learned there?
Well, I actually teach a graduate course at UCLA on the history of television and the evolution of multi-platform media. And it's, you know, it's mind-boggling for some of the students that were literally born in the 90s or late 80s to go back and look at the history of the transformation from radio to television, and from television and theatrical motion pictures to home video, and in each of those points in time, you know, there's a lot of interesting things we can talk about, such as, you know, how quick was adoption, how quick was it for commercial viability, but from a pure contract point of view, at each point in time where there has been a disruptive technology, people have had to go back and look at their contracts and say, well, what exactly did I give away? Or what exactly did I acquire? And notwithstanding that, one of the big lessons learned when television and home video created the disruption and people started using the language of, you know, all media now and hereafter known, ever devised throughout the universe and in any other universe ever discovered, That's not necessarily, people didn't always get all the full scope of rights. And so you still see in contracts that we go back for our clients all the time and look at, you know, old chain of title on library acquisitions, you know, things like a grant of, you know, all television rights. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean today, particularly with IPTV and mobile TV? To me, the biggest lesson learned looking back at prior disruptive technologies is to keep in mind that the speed of which we have new disruptive technologies today is vastly quicker than what it was, and I think it will continue to be. And so we have to keep in mind that, how many people in the room would have contemplated Twitter as a commercial platform, even 18 months ago, right? We just don't know what the future holds, and so we have to think about that when we're either acquiring rights or conveying them away.
A question for Alan. What would you recommend then in terms of a very broad grant of rights? Would you say that all media now known or hereafter devised throughout the universe is not broad enough?
Oh no, I think that's broad enough.
But I hope so.
It's just that you don't always get a complete buyout, right? You don't always get everything. In fact, more likely than not, you're acquiring on a territory basis or a, you know, type of media basis. And so, you know, take a good example is what the publishing industry. I know you're going to talk about that. Someone's going to talk about the electronic books and books, the video books, and the problems the publishers are having with their electronic book right grants from contracts going back over the last couple decades or more, and whether they have those rights or not. And that's going to, you know, continue to be a problem unless people are very, very careful at how they define those rights, knowing that they're not going to necessarily know what all the future holds, unless, of course, you're in the you have the luxury of acquiring everything. But that's not always the case.
And if I may, I think I can say at least one thing certain, that if we ever do have visitors from another universe not yet discovered, they're not coming here for the TV and film rights would be, I think, almost a given.
They want the
tweeting rights, absolutely. Well, Alan, your experience has acquainted you with the concerns of the various guilds here, which is a whole subject area that I'm still learning about. So if you could, talk a bit about the three guilds and how their concerns as new media is evolving are coming to the fore.
Sure. Well, you know, you're always going to have a tension between the creative community and the financiers and distributors, and we are in a capitalist economy where we give a little bit greater balance of weight to the financiers and the distributors than some other countries do. You know, a lot of countries like France have certain inherent creative rights that can't be conveyed away.
Are you speaking of moral rights? Is it
as an example, right? Right. Rights of attribution, rights of integrity. That is not the case in the United States, excepting to the extent that there are contractual agreements made between the creative community and the producer community, Throughout the history of our entertainment industry, we've had the primary guilds, the above-the-line guilds, being for the writers, the actors, and the directors. And they have served two purposes. One is to deal with creative rights, credit, particularly for directors, certain amount of integrity, and compensation. And the compensation is as, if not more, important for the creative community than some of their creative rights. Now, WGA, if anyone's ever tried to wade through the morass that is separated rights. That's another example of creative rights that the writers have been able to get that sort of does an end run around copyright by providing television writers some certain reserved rights under certain circumstances that they wouldn't otherwise normally have. So as new media has started to evolve, notwithstanding that we're still talking about, we're not in digital pennies anymore, we're in digital dimes as compared to analog dollars, but it's still, you know, a blip on the economic screen compared to the traditional distribution mediums. That notwithstanding, if anyone followed the guild negotiations recently, we had a 100-day strike with the WGA. We had very contentious SAG negotiations, and part of that was because the creative community got a little burned with home video, and to a lesser degree cable television, and so there is a hesitancy, and I don't represent the creative community. I represent the financiers and the distributors and the producers. But that notwithstanding, I can understand the viewpoint of some in the creative community that, hey, they took a hit on home video, getting a piece of the pie as opposed to a piece of all the pie. So most compensation and back end and royalties and such on home video are based on 20%. Of the home video dollar, not 100% of the home video dollar. And cable rates were significantly lower than broadcast rates. And all that was when these new mediums were in their infancy. And you've watched home video basically go through its growth and starting to go into decline. Well, that model's not going to change now that it's in decline, and the creative community kind of missed the boat when it was at its peak. So they have some concerns about whether or not they're going to miss the economic boat in new media. So if anyone's interested, I don't want to take up all the time and other people here want to speak. In Q&A, I'll be glad to talk about some of the details of the guild arrangements, but for the most part, they break into a few categories. There's certain creative rights. There's all the workplace rights. It gets the unions their foot in the door with signatory status in this medium, and there is some minimum compensation both for new original made for internet productions for SAG, WGA. It's negotiated on a per deal basis, and then also reuse. Compensation if an event, something was made for the internet, but then it really gets broadcast on television first. And then finally, some greater definition of what is promotional use, to what degree promotional content can be used and on what platforms that is truly promotional and not commercial. Importantly, to the point that you know, this is still in its early growth period. These agreements sunset in June of 2011. Notwithstanding the pain that the industry went through to get there, we're going to be quickly revisiting it.
Well, thank you for that heads up, Alan Friel from Wildman Herald, and I'd like to move now in our discussion about drafting the next new media contracts to Cindy Charles. And to Alan's point about new media and evolving media, you're from a company that has evolved itself, right? You're MediaNet now, but you were MusicNet before.
Right. So our company was formed about 10 years ago. The concept, it was formed by three of the major record labels, Warner, EMI, BMG, and Real Networks, as a technology company, and the concept was, how do we combat piracy? Napster was in full bloom, and the record labels were at a complete loss as to what to do, so their concept was, let's form a company where we can try to come up with a legitimate legal marketplace for the sale of music. So we were formed, as was another company, Pressplay, which was a Universal and Sony venture, which ultimately was sold and then morphed into the new Napster. So we were founded prior to Apple coming out with the iPod. The labels wanted to sell music on a subscription basis. And we sold subscriptions or offered subscriptions through AOL and Real Networks at the time. And it was, we offered, I think it was $9.95 for all the content you can access for on a monthly basis. You'd pay $9.95 a month. You'd get the songs on your computer. If you didn't continue to pay, the songs would expire. And then early on, we bundled in downloads, but the labels wouldn't let us sell songs on an a la carte basis because they didn't want to move into the singles business. So they sold them as packages. So that was a very interesting concept, which then Apple turned on its head when Apple started offering songs on an a la carte basis. And what it did was it transformed the CD business into the singles business. And so the record labels have now... there's a long history here, but the point that you want me to make is we've...
yes, please.
We've come around now to looking at subscription businesses again as a viable business model, and there were a host of reasons why that could not happen prior to now, but one is the fact that there was digital rights management on content. Now everything, all music is offered on an MP3 basis, so there are no restrictions. That's one thing. The technology has evolved. There are there's the capability now for mobile phones to to access streams, so consumers can have streams through their mobile devices. And so now we can once again look at subscription models in a new way, you know, similar types of offering, all you can eat, you know, seven million songs as opposed to 70,000 songs.
Right. So, and I think the point there is that the unpredictability of the market, and it took several permutations before you, if you will, have come back to where you were. The subscription model was if not a non-starter, a difficult start because it was tied to the desktop.
Right,
but
it was tied
now
to
we're in an environment where the streaming becomes a practical application given the adoption of mobile phones.
That's right. There was a history also of what was called conditional downloads, which were tied, which were you can transfer a song through your computer to a device, which would also time out, but the experience was very clunky, and consumers didn't really understand the experience. And now there's a much more simpler, there's a simple marketing message around streaming through devices that did not exist prior to that.
Right. So in lining people up to be able to provide their product to the consumer and taking Alan's point about sort of building the plane while we're flying it, have you got any hints around the best provisions in such contracts or the way to be thinking about it before you sit down to write?
Well, it's been very difficult because what we were dealing with and what the entire music industry has been dealing with is competing with free. So we had a situation with piracy that none of the other media, no other media, although now, you know, film and TV because of bandwidth, you know, is experiencing a similar issue. But the music was out there and it was free. So we had to come up with business models and, you know, continue to try to do that with the labels where we can offer something to the consumer that they will be willing to pay for. And Apple has, you know, created a model where they offer songs for a dollar, you know, 99 cents or $1.29, and... But what they're really doing is they're selling where they make their generate their revenue is from devices, not from content. And so we're also, as a B2B provider of digital music, we're also competing with entities that are really selling something else and using content as almost a loss leader.
Well, right. And, you know, the music industry, just to take them as an example, but it applies, I'm sure, across the board, was accustomed at one point to being in the driver's seat, and now that's not the case. And how so when you're trying to structure a deal, does that matter? How difficult is it?
Well, you know, if you have all the leverage, it's very difficult, because if you have all the leverage like Apple, because now Apple owns this market, they dictate to the record labels, here's what we're going to do, and basically take it or leave it. In our situation now, after many years, the labels have come to the conclusion that they need to develop a robust marketplace. So there is a lot more, I find, a lot more flexibility in these negotiations in terms of pricing, you know, the economics around subscriptions, downloads, bundling subscriptions into other products and services, because the goal in our business, and I think this also relates to all businesses, is to create a viable marketplace and not let, in the case of ebooks, Amazon or Apple own the market, because otherwise there's the entire business is going to suffer as a result of one entity like Apple in the case of music owning the entire marketplace. So in my case, I'm always trying to negotiate for the best deal I can, and you know, we're not Apple, we don't have a lot of leverage. I did work at MTV where I had a lot of leverage, so it's, you know, the flip of that. But
nevertheless, there's a case to be made to the providers that having more than just Apple as their channel is in their interest.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, it's key. And so what we've been struggling with is how can we convince the labels, could, because we have to offer everything. We're not, you know, it's not like the film business or television business where you can get a few of the providers and you can make an offering. If we are offering a subscription model or even a permanent download model to consumers, they want to know they have access to millions and millions of songs, not just songs from Warner Music Group. So we have to manage each one of the major labels and then all of the independent labels who are on to the major label deals. So it's so it's very challenging. But the provisions that we focus on, you know, there are no exclusivity provisions. It's really about economics. It's about pricing more than anything.
Right. And one of the themes of our discussion today, I think, is about the lessons learned and how, you know, since new media has now sort of evolved to become all media, there are some lessons, some hard lessons, and others learned from the music business's experiences mm-hmm. that apply to, for example, the book business, which, even though we're here at Digital Hollywood, we know that there's a strong relationship between the two. And in fact, what's interesting is the way that Apple has kind of flipped. When they moved from iTunes to the iPad and starting to have the iBook store, they did some jujitsu on Amazon, who tried to mm-hmm. sort of work the same magic with books that Apple mm-hmm. had worked with music. Talk about
right.
that, and we should perhaps fill people in. There was the Amazon model, which was setting a price, and this new so-called agency model that Apple has agreed to.
Right. So in the parallel in the music business is Sony had none of the other labels except for Sony had decided they want to be the merchant of record selling downloads. So that what they call the agency model. So the distributor is the agent, and then the agent takes a fee, but Sony gets the full retail price. So they set the retail price, and then the way it typically works is we get a wholesale price from the labels. We then are allowed to mark it up as we want, and sometimes they get a percentage of the overall price if it's higher than, you know, than the wholesale price. But Sony felt adamantly that they did not want downward pricing pressure, and so they wanted to be able to dictate the price. They didn't want music to be given away for free as promotion, so they're requiring all of the distributors to abide by these restrictions, where they are setting the retail price and they're the retailer. So the book publishing business apparently has taken up that charge as a result of Amazon putting downward pricing pressure. What Amazon was doing, because they wanted to own the market because it's a closed system with Kindle, is gain market share And then, so they reduced the price of the books, so the books became, I think it was $9.99 rather than, you know, you go to a bricks and mortar store and it's, you know, $20 or $28 or whatever. So, and then they would pay the publisher their wholesale price, which let's say is $13. And then, so basically they were taking a loss on every book in order to
Amazon was taking a loss on every book in order to sell
the Kindle. What happened then was, and they had no competition, what happened was Apple came in and Jobs had discussions with each of the publishers and they were furious about that. And the publisher said they want to be the merchant of record. They want to be the retailer, and they want to dictate the retail price, because if the perception in the marketplace is that books are $10, they're dead. They're, you know, because you go into a bookstore, it's like, my ebook is $10. Why is my, you know, my hardcover $25? So it's a real killer. So, so anyway, they insisted, and Jobs accepted the agency model, and I think he basically said, you know, you have 1 year to figure this out, and so then Amazon was forced to accept the agency model as well.
Right.
So currently, they're both, I think most of the major publishers are dictating retail price, and but they have 1 year. So my advice to the publishing community is, that's fine, but you need as many distributors as possible, because otherwise, after the year, when Amazon and Apple own the market, you're in the same place the music business
well,
is.
Well, we just read in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week that Google is about to get into the book business, so that is beginning to evolve there. And what's interesting, we don't have to do the math right now, but in that switcheroo, the book publishers end up getting less.
Mm-hmm. But they're happy to
because they're preserving the price on the print side. Cindy, thank you for that, Cindy Charles. And I want to move now to Virginie Perron, who has an interesting perspective, I think, Virginie, in your previous background, but as the co-founder of the Artist Law Group, you are sort of interacting between Silicon Valley and Hollywood. Talk about that experience and specifically how it applies to some of the clients that you work with.
Sure. So I started my career in the Silicon Valley representing startup companies, then moved down here and moved into, I don't know if this works, yes, moved into more of the entertainment realm, but still with a new media kind of bent to my practice. And what I find interesting, more so than new media, as said Alan, which really doesn't mean anything these days, is because everything is evolving, so everything is new to some extent. But what I find really interesting in my practice is the interplay between startup companies and talent, or the Silicon Valley and Hollywood, if you will, because these are two very different cultures, and their approach to contractual relationships are also very different. So, you know, representing a startup company, usually you have a small company with a novel business model, which hopefully is interesting. They don't necessarily have proprietary technology. They have a good idea. And so what they need to do is corner the market. And if they're dealing with content, sign as many artists as possible, as quickly as possible to corner that market before, you know, competitors decide this is a good idea, we're going to do the same thing. So their approach to contracts is, again, a land grab, as Ellen was saying, and a quick one. So from an artist perspective, you know, a lot of artists are looking these days for new revenue streams, because all the revenue streams are shrinking, so they need to expand the scope of their revenue streams. So artists generally are interested in those new business models, but they're also wary, because when you're dealing with a new company, you don't know where they're going. There's no standard model to deal with. When you're doing a record deal, you know, you get a $1.25 penny rate, you're happy, you know that standard, and you're good to go. When you're dealing with a new model, you don't really know what everybody else is getting. There's no standard, so that's a concern. So moving, you know, from different provisions, looking at a royalty provision, what's important to know from the artist's perspective is that you're getting a deal that let's say, dealing with the uncertainty, what I try to do with when I represent the talent is to get a most favored nation provision so that I know that whatever they're offering us is going to be standard across the board, or at least the best deal that the artist can get. Not only with respect, if you're dealing with a royalty structure, not only with respect to the royalty rate, but also the calculation model. If you're dealing with net, if you're dealing with gross, watch out for deductions. That can be really aggressive. So from a royalty standpoint, that's what I'm concerned with. From a term standpoint, as you were saying, you want to minimize the term from the artist's perspective because you don't know what the market's going to look like in a year. Obviously, from the startup perspective, you're trying to get as long a term as possible. Termination provisions are important from the artist's perspective. You know, if the startup stops doing business in the normal course, for instance, you know, some of them go dormant because they're looking for funding or things like that. You don't want to be tied up with them. If there's any bankruptcy proceedings that are start against them, that's also important to have a termination provision for that type of situation. And again, minimize the term. Exclusivity is something that the startup is going to try to go after, again, to counter any possible competition once they launch and everybody decides this is a really good idea and they want to start signing talent. As an artist, you know, if you represent the talent, you're going to try to avoid exclusivity to the extent possible. If that's not possible, then you try to make sure there are parameters around it, some benchmarks that have to be met, or the exclusivity goes away, or the agreement terminates. Scope of rights, as we were talking about that, that's also very important. When I represent the licensee, the startup that's getting content in, what I try to do these days, because it's really hard to anticipate what kind of media you're going to need or what kind of business you're going to be in a year, I try basically to have a catch-all provision in all media now known or hereafter devised. And if it's a concern from the other side, then what I suggest is just carve out. You know, you go to the licensor and say, okay, what medium are you concerned about? Is it TV? Let's carve this out. Is it theatrical? Let's carve this out. But let's make sure we have a, from the startup perspective, let's make sure we have a catch-all. Assignability is also very important for a startup company. If you're going to start signing talent, you're aggregating content, and you have an exit strategy that might involve merger acquisition, you want to make sure that the content goes with you if you get acquired, so that you're not held hostage by a bunch of artists who are going to, you know, ask for payment or try to get out of their contract once you get bought. From the artist perspective, the concern, I've had that happen, actually yesterday I was working on a deal on the artist side, and the artist tells me, you know, she keeps talking about Darren, the CEO, she's friends with the CEO, great. She's like, no concern, he's a great friend, I trust him completely. Well, yeah, when Darren gets bought out in a year, what's going to happen? So from the talent perspective, if you sense that your artist is really going from a relationship perspective into this agreement, then maybe try to use a keyman provision, which is very entertainment-based. Silicon Valley people don't know what that, you know, they're not used to this, but why not throw it at them and see what you can get from that perspective? That might come in very handy in case of an acquisition. From the most important advice I would say I have for a startup company going into the entertainment realm and trying to sign as many artists as possible. Presumably, they have no money to throw at the artists, and what's really tricky is to get people's attention, get management and legal to actually look at the contract and spend the time. And if you come to them with a 30-pager for a simple name and likeness type of deal, which is something I was working on recently, again, on the talent side, you know, they threw at us, it's like a 13-page contract for name and likeness, and, you know, you could tell it was a big New York lawyer who was trying to throw everything in but the kitchen sink. And, you know, looking at this, the company is trying to reach critical mass, and what difficulty they're going to encounter is that when a lawyer sees that, there's no money in, the manager doesn't care, there's no money, there's no advance, this is no rush, it might be interesting, it might be incremental revenue, but who knows. But if you make the deal very difficult and very complex, you're going to go to the bottom of the pile, and this is really going to hurt you in terms of building critical mass. And that's real. It sounds like very simple advice, but I would say, having worked at a startup that needed to achieve critical mass very quickly, that's the first thing that I looked at as general counsel. Let's get a licensing agreement that is simple and that will go through very easily. And, you know, I came up with a 3-pager that was solid, and that's really, oftentimes young entrepreneurs, you know, they want to get the big lawyer, and the more language and the more, you know, complicated the agreement looks, the better it probably is, because they don't really understand all that stuff. What I learned working in the Silicon Valley is that it's very difficult to make a contract simple and still tight and something that works. And that's really key working with a young company that is trying to, again, build critical mass. And that's my first piece of advice when I have a client. Let's do something that's simple, tight, that works, that will stand, you know, that will stand up in court, but that is going to make it easy for you guys to sign people quickly. Easily.
Well, some great ideas there for drafting this new media contract that we're talking about. And I want to focus again on this point about your experience with Silicon Valley and Hollywood. We're here at something called Digital Hollywood, which isn't quite the oxymoron that, say, the newspaper business is now, right? But it's still in a struggle, I think, to understand each other. Does that make sense? And that there's contractual baggage that both the, what I'll call the legacy companies and the startups are coming to the table with. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I have to say that it's gotten much better. I mean, there's a huge difference. About 15 years ago, when I was in the Silicon Valley, we're all starting, trying to figure things out. Everybody was running around, you know, young CEOs didn't know what they were doing. I was a baby lawyer. I didn't know what I was doing. It was just complete craziness. Trying to deal with the entertainment business and trying to get content signed up with our startup companies. And I remember a partner came to me, and we were working with some music company, music startup. They were signing artists. And the partner comes to me to discuss the agreement, the template that we're going to work on for that startup. And the first thing he says is, well, we're dealing with musicians, so I think we should put color in the contract. That'll attract them. And that's the kind of disconnect that you are dealing with. You know, the tech people looked at the artists as those crazy people, not so smart, that didn't know what they were doing. And then the entertainment industry was looking at Silicon Valley with some arrogance, you know, having worked in the music business. And so there was a massive disconnect. And now I have to say it's much better. I mean, I don't see that much of a disconnect anymore. We've learned to speak with each other, or at least I've learned to make them talk to each other in a similar language, at least.
Right. Well, but nevertheless, there will be problems. There are contracts that means there will be problems, which brings me to John Gaddy here. John's here to talk about the problems. If you don't want to hear about the problems, I guess you have to leave now. But John Gaddy is a partner at Strook & Strook and a litigator, and so you are the person who deals with the consequences of all of this. Talk about that perspective when it comes to new media contracts. Again, bearing in mind what we've been hearing, which is this is all so much evolving as we are speaking, really.
No, thank you. And that is true. It is all evolving. And guess what? When it's evolving, there are problems.
There are crashes on those planes that we're building in the
issues. Alan spoke earlier of disruption. I'm on the side of the ledger, I guess, where disruption means opportunity in some respects. And what we're doing is really managing that. We do get involved on the front side in the deal making, because people are now, I think, in tune with it and looking at how is this going to play out at the end of the day. We're still in the legal system, so you're talking about contracts, and you're talking about what was the intent of the parties and what was the meeting of the minds. Was there a meeting of the minds? And I come from the end of things where I have to take that situation, that agreement, which may have been done, you know, in a shorthand basis, may have been done with startup companies that were not as established in whatever business model they were going to apply going forward, and maybe the business model changed. And now we're telling this story, and we're in front of 12 individuals who are the jurors, who some may be as sophisticated as people in the room, others don't know from anything about new technology, evolving technology. So, and a lot of the judges, by the way, who are making determinations on the contracts that people are putting together are not that well-versed in it at all themselves. So I guess my point would be eventually you have to look at the end game there if there is going to be litigation. And the advice is to make things as clear as possible, because that is going to be what will – that contract at the end of the day is going to be on trial itself. And to be clear, is the best obviously advice you can give. The types of issues that definitely come up in the litigation area are, as others on the panel have mentioned, business models change. Parties that are going into a contract may believe they're going down a particular model, and then guess what? You know, 6 months later, that model changes. However, the parties to the contract may not be provided for in this situation where a model changes. So,
right. And just to say, I mean, the change is being made in the interest of one or the other. It can't necessarily benefit all.
Correct. And so when we look at agreements on the front end, we try to work with our transactional attorneys and look for the different alternatives and you try to think of what you can, and you try to build in language that provides for changes in the landscape as things go forward. It becomes especially true when, as Alan was talking about, there's repurposing of entertainment projects that deal with contracts that went back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even contracts in the 80s and 90s don't necessarily provide as well as you would like them to with the new technologies and the evolving technologies. So you will have situations that there will be conflict there. And how are those rights interpreted, and was the contract in 1960, 1970 providing for the type of technology we're talking about today? So when you're looking at contracts today, trying to avoid the litigation down the road, is, as others have mentioned, is you want to be as expansive as possible, try to be as inclusive as possible. With respect to the changing business models that people are faced with, I believe sometimes building in benchmarks for performance is a good way to provide for an out for a party if they need to. If things are not going the way they thought and things are not progressing the way they anticipated, they have an out built into it so that in litigation or trying to thwart litigation, you have specific exit procedures so that you're not deemed to be in breach when the game plan has changed on you. So I think that's one of the ways to try to anticipate those type of problems. In today's environment, obviously, Virginia was talking about dealing with startups, and obviously you always will be dealing with startups in this area. Startups, you know, some go on to be Google, some end up on the roadside. And if you're somebody coming in and providing content, one of the more important things you want to look at is if we have to enforce our rights against a company that is not viable, what do we do? What do we provide for? Some of the provisions you can obviously look at are the various indemnity clauses, various default issues. Companies may end up in bankruptcy, so you want to be able to, on the front end of things, try to, as best you can, put into the agreements how things will be treated. Those come in with reversion rights. If certain things are happening at the company where your rights are going, the last thing you want as somebody who's providing rights, let's say, to a particular entity, is to have your rights caught up in a litigation and bankruptcy or other. There are issues that aren't as, you know, you're not quite at bankruptcy, but for the rights holder or the person who's granted the rights, it may as well be bankruptcy because your rights are tied up. You can't get to them. And so provisions such as reversion rights, with, again, benchmarks as to if things are happening or not happening, then those rights revert back to you, and you're free to take it down the road. Those are all obviously negotiation points, but those are points that are very important from a litigation standpoint, just to protect yourself on the front end to see what you may be faced with in litigation. And again, getting back to many people in the industry, when you're talking about new technologies, tend to speak sometimes in shorthand or industry usage of terms, and everyone around the table at that particular time understands 100% what everyone is talking about. However, once you get into litigation, you start to learn how much people don't remember that that's exactly what everyone meant and give a different definition to it. And you're having to give a definition to, again, as I say, 12 people in a jury box that are going to eventually make the decision. And that's scary, and that's why, you know, many people will, the parties will try to avoid litigation or build in arbitration provisions so that at least they have a little more control over the process if they can, because it can be a scary proposition that something such as who holds the rights to a particular, either rights or technology and how it's going to be applied may be end up being bet the company type of litigation. And it's a scary proposition when you're putting that decision with some individuals who may not be as well-versed.
Right. And John, that warning about the possible consequences of not clearly defining jargon sort of strikes me as related to what Virginie was saying before about plain, simple, and all of that, and is a great cautionary note. So when we talk about new media, many of these issues are really old issues, but when we were chatting before the program, you brought up a scenario that I thought was interesting, and particularly in light of this notion that there are jurors and judges who might not be fully acquainted with email. So if you bring up with them something like virtual realities and Second Life and so forth, that's going to take them to a world beyond, maybe to that other universe that we were chatting about before. Can you just bring up what that's like, as a litigator? You've got someone who may feel that they've been defamed in Second Life, for example.
Sure. I guess the old adage applies that, follow the money. And in social networking sites and Second Life, those sorts of sites, there's real commerce being conducted there. And it's now, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of real commerce. So when there is that economic opportunity, the old rules apply, and you're still working within the legal system. So can you defame somebody in Second Life? Those cases are now in front of the courts, and determinations are being made that, yes, you can. Can you interfere with the business relationships of this make-believe world? Well, when you're paying real dollars in the make-believe world, yes, you can be sued for interfering with contractual relations. And how it's really coming up is somebody will create a business on, let's say, Second Life, where they are generating, economic dollars, real dollars, and somebody is bad-mouthing that business for the benefit of their business that they're operating in the virtual world. And it has a real economic damage. And if there's real economic damage, there can be a real case in the legal system. And those cases are starting to work themselves through the system. And so when you're in that area, there are the real concerns that you have, as you would be in the actual world we all live in, and that goes for right of privacy, defamation, and we've represented companies such as Cartier, who have had their trademarks infringed in the virtual world, with people creating designs that are a copy of the of Cartier and others like that, and they're bringing infringement actions and piracy actions in the virtual world because there's money being generated. So from their perspective, if there's money being generated off of their rights, they will pursue them.
John, I wonder if we can expect virtual courtrooms then at some stage?
I'm sure people are hoping they're virtual
probably,
attorneys.
Absolutely, that would be, with a virtual bill at the end, yes.
Yeah, if I could add to what John said, you know, I guess about 15 years ago, other than the application of then-existing intellectual property law to the medium, everything was a clean slate. There were no laws. There was no regulatory overlay. And that's not... That IP overlay is not insignificant. Indeed, it's very complex, and there's a lot to think about there. But we now layer on top of that a whole set of laws, some of which would provide potential protections to those websites that you just talked about, the Communications Decency Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and the contours of those are being challenged and fleshed out by those judges that you mentioned that have no idea what the technology is or what the business models are. But on top of that, we now have really intense regulatory schemes that relate to the use of the medium. And with the Obama administration and the new FTC, we're going to see that, I think, drastically increase. In fact, it was just this week that the FTC announced that they are completely revamping the privacy scheme, which has to date been a basically a notice and kinda consent, not really scheme, and yesterday, Boucher introduced his draft bill for a vastly re-regulated privacy scheme for all data, both on and offline. You've got an opt out scheme for email. You have an opt in scheme for mobile. And so for the business people and the technologist, it has gone from a wild, wild west where you could pretty much do anything you want and the law will catch up to you, to where the law is really ahead of the technologists now in many ways, and not necessarily in the right ways. The level of complexity to exploiting the medium has certainly grown.
Well, I want to thank the contributions of everybody on the panel today and then turn it over to you and the audience here for some questions. But first of all, thank you, Cindy Charles from MediaNet, Virginie Perron from Artist Law Group, John Gaddy at Strook & Strook, and finally, Alan Friel from Wildman & Harold. Thank you all for a great discussion. Appreciate it.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.